Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to another Word in Your Ear. Once again, we're starting early because, you know, as you, if you've been to one of these things in the past, you'll know that our solemn promise is that you'll be looking at the inside of your lids by about 9:45.
Yeah? By about 7:45.
Because we, you know, we don't have the stamina to go on any longer, and you probably don't either. Thanks very much for coming. Particularly in the middle of the European Championship, we got two turns this evening, two guests. In the second half of the evening, we've got Sylvia Patterson, who's talking about her book "I'm Not with the Band." But we start with for the first time in a Word in Your Ear with a photographer. We're very fortunate to be joined by a very distinguished photographer who's obviously, you're probably familiar with a lot of his pictures of famous people, of which you're going to see a smattering. But also, I think it's fair to say that he first made his name by taking pictures of not-so-famous people, some of whom became kind of famous through his photography, because he observed at close quarters, when nobody else did, a scene where the audience were, to a certain extent, the stars. And a certain number of those pictures from that particular phase are collected in this terrific new book, Punk London 1977. Would you please welcome Derek Ridges? So, Derek, we're going to start with a bit of background, really, of how you got into photography. Because you didn't train as a photographer or anything like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, no, it's completely fair.
Hold your mic a bit closer.
I wasn't interested in photography at all when I was young. I went to art school in the 60s, and we had photography lessons half a day a week, but I just wasn't interested. I wanted to be a painter in those days. And things could have been so different had I been accepted by the Slade or St. Martin's, which I wasn't.
So how did you get into taking photographs of musicians?
Well, I became an art director in an advertising agency or a series of advertising agencies, and I had a job for an agency called Maisie Mukherjee Russell in Camden Town, above the Plaza Cinema. And we had an account for Miranda cameras, 35mm camera. I hadn't seen one around for years, so probably not still going. And the MD said to me, you know, if I wanted to write some good ads for the camera, I should take one home and practice. And, you know, I thought, well, it's fair enough. And so I started going out at weekends, sometimes photographing rusty cars and sunsets and the sort of things that amateur photographers do.
Is that what they do?
It's
rusty cars. I never thought of that one.
Rusty old abandoned cars.
Anything that looks poignant.
Yeah, on bomb sites and stuff like that. I mean, this is still when there were bomb sites around. There aren't so many around in London.
When do we talk about here? We talk about the early 70s?
No, this would be, well, probably 73, 74, yeah. So I started to take a camera home. And then my girlfriend and I, now wife, went to the Rainbow to see the famous concert with Eric Clapton.
This was when
Townsend.
That's right, and Clapton had been in a kind of heroin fug for about 18 months, and no one had seen him.
Yeah, and we had a seat. When we got there, we were right at the back, the very last row, and I thought, I happened to have a camera with me, and I rather unchivalrously left my girlfriend in her seat, and I ran to the front and pretended to be a photographer, just so I could get a bit closer.
Well, you just leapt into the pit?
I'm not sure that there was a pit, but
It was a very high stage of the Rainbow, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there may well have been. But, you know, the thing was, there were a few photographers, and I just ran down. In those days, there weren't really many security guys to chuck you out. So if you looked like you should be there, people just left you alone. And I probably shot a roll or half a roll, and when I got home, I thought, well, I might as well get it processed. And I quite liked the pictures. I thought it gave me a kind of feeling of exuberance to be so close to people that were my heroes. So I started to do that more and more.
So it's extraordinary that the first thing that you took a picture of is one of those rare concerts that is still quite remembered, isn't it? You know, that they famously, they had to cut his suit, didn't they, so he could get into the suit. Because he put on so much weight.
One of the byproducts of taking a lot of heroin, apparently, is you just eat vast numbers of Mars bars.
Yeah.
So he sat in a
house somewhere.
That's right. Just eating vast amounts of chocolate. And there's a huge... That let a kind of dart into the back of the trousers so he could get into them.
I wouldn't know about that. Yeah. I enjoy
sadly,
the old
not,
Mars
not
bar.
Seen the pictures.
So you started in the pit and you took other pictures in the pit.
Yeah, well, picture was from Earl's Court, I think at 73 or 74, but I was just in the audience, so I just happened to have a slightly better ticket at that point, but it was chance, really.
But the things have really changed, haven't they? Because younger groups, the Stones at that stage, would be so confident about their looks that they would allow someone to be in the pit the entire concert. Now you only get three numbers.
Oh, yeah.
Because after that, people start to perspire and their hair gets flat and they start to look terrible.
Or I think it's sometimes less than three numbers now.
Because they just rush them in at the beginning and they take them straight out. But is there any part of you that can sympathise with the musicians over that? That they don't necessarily want a bunch of people
between
them and the audience?
I'm not sympathetic at all. I mean, I think it might be better if it was the last three numbers
rather
than the first. Because sometimes the first three numbers, the band isn't even lit properly. You know, they're trying to build everything up. And, you know, it's very often they're not doing anything. It's just they start quietly. And, I wouldn't want to do it nowadays.
But this one, so you took this at Earl's Court, and it's an extraordinary image. I mean, how many pictures did you take on that particular occasion?
Well, probably maybe a couple of rolls, a roll of black and white and a roll of colour.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you shoot that many, how many usable pictures are you likely to get?
Oh, very few, I'm afraid.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was really just starting. I mean, it was potluck. I mean, I was the kind of person that probably opened the back of the camera whilst the film was still in it.
Yeah.
I did you know, they say you learn by your mistakes. I made the same mistake many, many times.
Because it's interesting to remember that in those days that camera technology was still quite intimidating, wasn't it? You
know,
you needed to look at the leaflet. And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think photographers wanted it to be like that. They didn't want it to be like it is today, where everyone can take a photograph, because it's kind of removed the career now.
Well, I wouldn't want to be a photographer right now, because you know, on any old iPhone, you can take pictures on things which you find light when light isn't even there. I mean, you can take extraordinarily good pictures in terrible situations with no skill at all.
Now, here we come to the period of time that I was talking about that's, you know, reflected in your book. Tell us about how you first came upon this tiny handful of people that were involved in punk rock in London.
I was a very keen music fan, really, throughout the late 60s and the 70s, and I used to go to a lot of gigs, usually with my wife, and I went to see the Vibrators at Kingston Poly. And went up to the front of the stage like I usually did, and all of a sudden the audience started to leap about and act very strange, you know, spitting and all that kind of thing. And I looked at them, I thought, well, this is quite photogenic. I, at that point, because it was such a surprise, I didn't have the gumption just to start photographing them straight away, but I kind of worked up to it. I read about the opening of the Roxy in December 76, and I decided I was going to go down there and photograph a few punks.
So go back with the Vibrators. When did you go and see the Vibrators?
This would have been autumn 76.
Autumn 76.
Because yeah. The interesting thing about this picture, of many interesting things, is that the people in the audience there are not punk rockers.
You know,
they're just the people who go to that club, and they could have just as easily been seeing Rugulator or Bees Make Honey or whatever.
Well,
and suddenly here's the Damned.
The early punks were a little bit like that. Richard Strange is right in the middle there. See him.
Just here. Which one?
That one.
Oh, yeah, with the big nose.
Yeah, yeah.
Went on to be the executioner in Robin Hood, the movie, didn't he? Kevin Costner movie.
So when is this and where is this?
This is at the Roxy, and it would be in the first 100 days of the Roxy.
Right, so this opened in late 1976.
It was December 15th, I think, or 16th.
Right, right. So it's interesting that it's still dated as kind of punk rock, you know, AD 1976. Yeah, yeah. But actually it happened later, didn't it, really?
Well, the punks seem to think 76 was the year. Everybody else, it was 77. And then if you go up north, it was 79, 80, 81.
Right.
So, you get to the west coast of America, it's probably happening now.
Yeah. So give us an idea of what it was like when you went into this place.
Well, it was tiny, very, very sweaty club. It was extremely hot. And these bits at the top, that's kitchen paper that was wrapped around the pipes. These things.
Right.
You know, because it was dripping.
Why? To stop the moisture.
It was dripping, and it was just trying to stop it. It wasn't a very classy place. It's a Speedo store now.
Right. Very classy now.
Yeah.
So what was it? You know, what did it feel like in there? What was the kind of mix of people?
Had people
gone there deliberately, or they just...
I think it was a mixture of punks and just curious people. Because at that point, punk was considered to be quite dangerous.
It wasn't
really dangerous, but people, the media build-up was for, you know, quite a dangerous thing.
Is that one of the things that attracted you about it?
I suppose it might have been, if I'm really honest. I mean, throughout my career as a photographer, looking back now, I think I've obviously had, a lot of it's very vicarious. Maybe I would have liked to have been a punk if I'd have been a couple of years younger. Maybe if I'd have been a little bit more of an alpha male, I would have been a skinhead. If I'd have been a bit older, I might have been a hippie. If my parents had enough money to buy me a scooter, I would have been a mod, you know, so...
But you're not bitter about missing out on all these opportunities. That's the
not
main
really,
thing.
Not really, no.
So you were just wandering amongst these people, you know, having been to see Eric Clapton and probably Bees Make Honey or whatever. How did these people regard you?
They were fine. They were always very nice to me. I mean, mostly very polite. I mean, I got spat on a few times and occasionally worse, but you know, it was okay, pretty much.
Worse than spat on?
Well, yes, yeah. It's probably not good for going on the radio though. I'll tell you afterwards.
Use our imagination.
Right.
Okay. But actually, I mean, really, they were mostly looking for attention, weren't they?
I suppose they
would have really welcomed being photographed. But
I made that monstrous effort
to dress up. You might as well, you know.
Most people were fine.
And where were you? Were you managing to place these pictures for publication?
To begin with. No, I just did it because I felt a compulsion. But probably by the summer of 77, I'd read in either NME or Sounds that Andy Chizowski, the guy that ran the Roxy, was going to do a record. And so I rang him up. I don't know where I got his number from. And said, I've got a lot of pictures from the club. And he said to me, well, we don't need them. We've got them all already, but bring them in anyway. And so I did. And they ended up going on the record and in the book, 100 Nights at the Roxy.
Right. Were you approached by the people whose pictures you were taking, saying, can I have a copy of that?
No, very
rarely.
People
not bothered about that?
Occasionally they did, yeah, occasionally, and I was quite happy to provide them with prints.
Right. Who's this? This is
Pauline from Penetration. Yeah.
So when would this be?
This would be in the spring of 77 as well.
Right. So they'd come down from, where was there, Middlesbrough, somewhere like that?
Yeah, certainly.
She wore a parachute suit or something. What is she actually wearing? It's extraordinary.
I don't know.
Any idea?
I have no idea.
It's interesting looking at these pictures. None of this stuff, like, there's a good example, actually. None of that stuff that anybody's wearing has been manufactured for them in a high street. They're wearing, they DIY'd themselves.
Yeah, that was very much the punk aesthetics to begin with. It was do it yourself.
Yeah. Do you get any idea of what kind of people they were, or what was their background, or what had got them there?
Mostly young, working class kids that wanted to listen to the music. Keen music fans.
So it was the music rather than the dressing up?
I think it was mostly the music. It was quite exciting music, I think. Very fast, very loud, quick. I think it was really the music.
But you had to have nerve to dress like that in 1976.
Yes, certainly, yeah.
77.
And some of those girls would have come straight from work with their stuff in a carry bag and got changed in the Roxy toilets, presumably.
Well,
after work.
I mean, some of them didn't even bother getting changed. Some of them came on the bus like that.
Looking
anyway.
Like that. Which was incredibly threatening at the time, wasn't it?
I suppose
a real statement.
Yeah, I suppose so. You've got to have a little bit of balls to get on the bus looking like that.
So, I mean, these, where did you take this?
That was at the Roxy as well. Most of these photos in the book are either from the Roxy or the Vortex. A few from other places like the Roundhouse and the Man in the Moon pub in Chelsea.
So what are they doing here, just sitting down at the end of a gig, or...?
Yeah, well, they would lark about, and I photographed them whilst they were larking about, and they probably finished larking about. Resting.
So were they kind of performing for you?
I think they were really performing anyway, a little bit, yeah.
Right. Because it is quite a significant group of people, isn't it? Because they did this on their own, quite a small number of people. They didn't read about this anywhere, did
Not
they?
Not really, no. I think the media did have some involvement in winding everybody up, because there were some other photographs from the punk wars when the punks wandered up and down King's Road in Chelsea and gangs of rockers and mods.
But then it all became, a commodity. The sound of sirens. We're back in Islington. You could buy postcards of people with giant Mohicans and all that.
Yeah, sure.
So it all changed.
I mean, I don't think there was any Mohicans early 77, probably late 77, 78 and onwards.
I think it says in the introduction to this book, there are no Mohicans.
No, there weren't any.
That was the kind of second phase, wasn't it?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
There's another thing in the introduction which I thought was interesting, was that the guy who wrote it said that he thought that punk rock was the most significant event that had happened in London's musical history. Is that something you agree with?
Well, most probably not, no. He's welcome to his opinion.
But you allowed it to go through.
Yeah. No, he's welcome
to his point of view.
It's his point of view. He could say.
Yeah. I mean, really, I'm an old hippie. Everything happened for me in the summer of love.
Right.
The first summer of
love. You're among friends, don't worry.
Yeah.
But you didn't resent any of this at all. You didn't.
I enjoyed it. It's just a little bit too old. I was two or three years too old to be a punk myself, I thought.
But I suppose it's only because you were two or three years too old that you bothered to take a camera.
Maybe.
Rather than.
Maybe. I really wish I'd have had a camera in the late 60s. Certainly. Yeah.
So tell us about these.
Yeah. Do you remember looking at it?
Debbie Harry here. Where do you take that?
That was at the Hammersmith Odeon when they played Blondie played with Television, and that was another one where I just ran down the front.
So they supported Television, did they?
I think it was a.
I must have been there.
I'm not sure which one supported the other one, but it was a good, very good gig. Yeah.
So you just tore down the front.
Yeah.
Took a picture. Yeah. Didn't have to sign a form saying,
No, I didn't have to sign away
PR release.
Copyright.
Allowing them copyright approval and
no,
photo
nothing
approval.
Like that.
Who is it on the far right? Is that Billy Idol, top right?
Yeah, that was the first night, and you can just see on the left Dave Bennett, famous paparazzi.
Oh, yeah. Did you get the impression that he was particularly, gifted, extravagantly, in any way going to... Do you think he was going to be a future star? Because... So at that stage, most people on stage could almost be members of the audience that could have got up there and started singing.
I'm not really able to judge. I mean, someone like Susie from Susie and the Banshees, it was really did seem to be quite amateur when they started. But in a way, I quite like that because it was very pared back and minimalist. I think they were actually better in those days, myself. Sorry to say.
But I suppose it's inevitable, isn't it, that people want to stay in that business, don't they?
Because
the great irony of the punk generation is that is when they came along, their message to the Rolling Stones or whoever was, you've been around too long.
Yeah.
Of course, they're all around just as long.
They're still, as the Rolling Spears is playing in some venue near to us right now, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because once you get in there and you become famous, they want to continue being famous.
The thing about
stop this.
Half of the punks, they didn't hate those bands anyway. It was just a position they were taking.
Yeah.
I went to see Adam and the Ants about 2 years ago at the Hammersmith Odeon, and that was fantastic because there he is, in fact. Because you had two parts of the audience. There was the kind of dandy highwayman pop supporters who were now all about in the late 40s and 50s. And then you had the old original, you know, Dirk Wears White Sox punks who are now all, you know, mostly Adam's age, in his 60. And some with green hair still, you know, and chains. It was fantastic. And some who clearly got a proper job.
The Ants, when they started, before it was Adam and the Ants at this point, they were a very good band. It was more R&B than punk, though, I think. They were a very good band.
That was the group that was stolen to be in, whatever they're called, Malcolm McLaren's other group.
Bow Wow Wow.
Bow Wow Wow, absolutely, yeah. Who's that bottom right? Anybody significant?
No, they're that's from the Vortex in Wardour Street.
Do you ever think about, or do you ever bump into any of these people nowadays?
On Facebook, yes, I do.
Oh, really? So people get in touch?
On top right here, her name's Helen. She was 15 when I photographed her. I just had one frame, and last year I found out who she was, and she was able to send me a picture of herself getting ready in the hotel earlier that same day with wearing the same clothes. It is quite amazing, the magic of Facebook.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, sure.
That's where old punks meet up.
So, I mean, how old are these people nowadays? Do you ever think of
it? I guess it's 39 years later, but some of them don't look any different, really.
What do you
believe it or not?
What, you bump into these people and they're still dressed like this?
No, but they facially they don't look 39 years different.
Right.
I don't know whether you've got a picture of the woman that's on the flyer for the...
possibly not.
For the Photographer's Gallery Punk Weekender. Well, I just did two frames of her in Wardour Street in 1978, and I met her again about 3 weeks ago. And... fantastic. Went down the pub with her, chatted about typography all evening.
That sounds thrilling.
Her dad's a famous designer.
This picture here of the police arresting somebody, where's this taken?
That was down in King's Road. They're just arresting her. She's probably done nothing wrong, but
what she'd done is probably just dress up like that, which is something you forget now. Nobody. It's such a conventional age that we live in now. You would never see anybody dressed in a manner that would get them arrested.
Yeah,
I mean, it just wouldn't happen, would it?
No, I wouldn't have thought so at all. Because now you then kind of move on in the early 80s to taking pictures of the kind of burgeoning new romantic.
Well, yes, I went to Billy's and photographed the Bowie nights that they had there, which was the start of the new romantics. It was run by Rusty Egan and Steve Strange, and I went there one night, and they'd moved on. They didn't think to tell me first because I was never really an insider. I was always really on the outside looking in, and I found a few of the skinheads there, and they came over to me and asked me to take some photographs of them, and that led to 5 years of photographing skinheads.
So they were in Billy's too?
They were, yeah.
That's kind of all at the same time. So you had coexisting.
All the really cool new romantics had moved on, but I didn't find out about that. And I found a few of the second division new romantics and a lot of skinheads.
I like the idea of you turning up too late. I think that's really good.
Oh, I was either too early
or
too late.
A load of blouses disappearing out of a door. Tea towels.
Yeah.
Peacock feathers. That's brilliant.
But you followed the skinheads for quite a few years.
For a
years,
while, they asked me to come down and take photographs.
So
were you followers? Well, not they didn't ask me to follow them. They just said, well, okay, we'll... you know, you can come along to South End at the bank holiday, and you know there'll probably be quite a lot of us down there, and there might be a ruck, so you should come along.
How did you feel about the prospect of that?
Well,
you're telling your wife, I'm going away for the weekend,
hoping for a ruck with my mates.
When I first met these skinheads, I thought there was some kind of art school revivalists. I didn't believe how fundamentally unusual they were. They had some very, very odd social and political views, and it took me a while to comprehend that.
So you thought they were fakes, basically?
Not really fakes. I just thought they were dressing up. But I found out they weren't dressing up at all.
Did you get any pictures of the ultra-violence that you're talking about?
No. I made a decision quite early on that I didn't want my presence to affect anyone getting hurt, so I wouldn't take any photographs of anyone fighting. But the thing was, I didn't really see any fighting anyway.
The old hippie in you coming out here.
Well, maybe. I very, very nearly got beaten up many times, but I think I had an angel on my shoulder the whole way through. If I'd have known then what I know now, I wouldn't even have started.
Beaten up for doing what? Just simply being there?
Just by being there.
With a camera?
Well, I went to South End with them, and a guy just walked over and kicked me straight in the balls without even saying hello, you know.
That's lovely, isn't it?
That was his introduction.
Yeah.
But
breaks the ice at parties.
And afterwards, he tried to take my camera off me as well, you know. So it was a bit of a wrestling match, and surrounded by a lot of other laughing skinheads, you know. But eventually, I managed to talk him round.
But as we've, you know, had calls to remark and in various podcasts over the years, what people do forget is late 70s, early 80s, gig-going in Britain was a potentially violent business, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a dangerous business.
Well, there were never any fights that I saw at the Roxy, but there was always a fight in the Vortex. There was a bit more space.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Stranglers used to have Hell's Angels as their personal stage bodyguards.
It's never a good
idea.
Which
is antagonistic, so yes, you know.
Now, here, you, this is interesting because there's a bunch of people who emerge from the new romantic audience,
sure.
I suppose, to become stars. Tell us about these people.
Well, Marilyn, top left.
Where's that taken?
That was outside his squat.
The squat he shared with Boy George.
He shared it with Boy George in Carburton Street.
Yeah.
Close to the Warren Street squats that were quite famous. This is Boy George in Le Beat Route. Steve Strange at Billy's. And this guy who's got We Are the Flowers in Your Dustbin tattooed on his forehead. That's Tuinel Barry. He's no longer around, sadly.
So, is Marilyn still around?
Marilyn, I was going to say, are you not in touch with Marilyn via Facebook, are you? I'd love to know what happened to Marilyn.
I suppose so, but
I interviewed him when I was at Smash Hits. He had one hit single. Remember Marilyn's hit single?
Yeah.
I mean, I think he is recording again now.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, he's looking quite cheerful.
Right.
Talking to stories that people will tell you later on, you know, if you buy Mark Ellen a drink, he'll tell you a story about Marilyn and Jim will fix it.
Oh, God.
Which is, you know,
it's a very long and involved story. Jim, God bless him, fixed it for Marilyn to be on the cover of Smash Hits with a 15-year-old girl who'd always wanted to be on the cover with
a
pop star.
What could possibly go wrong?
Jim, Marilyn, who our lawyers will allow me to tell you was addicted to heroin at the time. Chatting up all the people in reception who were dressed as firemen. Anyway, that was
going
wrong. But another time.
Yeah, pop music was interesting in those days. Was this the time that George was working in the foundry, the clothes shop?
Off Carnaby Street.
Yes, it was.
It was just at the point where he stopped being George O'Dowd and became Boy George.
Yeah. Slight transition. Yeah. So he was always... It's interesting, isn't it? Because we used to see him, because Smash Hits office was round the corner from the foundry.
100 yards from the foundry.
So we'd see him sitting in the window, this guy, and he was just acting like a superstar.
We thought it was fantastic. We actually got a photograph of him, put him in the magazine, and huge amounts of mail. People just wanted more pictures of him, which is precisely what the job you were doing, really.
Yeah.
By photographing those people and getting their pictures published in whichever magazines. What would it have been? The Face at that time?
The Face, yeah.
Yes, it was.
Time Out occasionally as well.
Yeah.
Because there was then this big movement towards, I think, ID magazine probably pioneered this as much as anything else.
Yeah.
Kind of, what do they call them, straight ups, these pictures?
That's right.
People in the street, you know, where did you get your clothes?
What are you wearing?
Who are you? How old are you? Where have you come from?
Yeah.
You know? Because everybody had a story then.
Yeah.
You can't do it nowadays. Where do you get your clothes?
People wanted to dress like
Where do you get your clothes? The Gap.
So the Gap tells you nothing about the person at all.
It's, you know, they people put a lot of effort into that stuff in those days, didn't they?
Yeah, sure.
So,
Is it Robbie Williams? Who is
this
it?
Is Robbie Williams. Oh, yeah. Not Robin Williams. Here. I just picked out a few of your celebrity pictures.
Yeah.
I guess you've obviously moved on from taking pictures of the audience to taking, although you still do this, do you? I mean, what's it you do?
I don't take any photographs of rock stars or celebrities anymore, but I had 25 years of it and really enjoyed it. I enjoyed every moment of it. It was fantastic. Travelling about the world at other people's expense, you probably know about all
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I think we're going to have more of that later in the evening with Sylvia, actually. Yes. But it's quite interesting, this. So when did you take this?
That was probably the late 90s.
Right, okay.
Yeah. No, and he was fine. He was just acting up.
No, sure. I wasn't just... No, it's just interesting, isn't it, how this became the kind of new standard way for a rock star to have their picture taken, you know?
Yeah.
I'll flick the fingers at you.
It was a famous...
It'll make me a rock star, won't it?
Yeah.
You know, because you look... Think about the Johnny Cash...
Johnny Cash. It was a famous picture of Johnny Cash giving the middle finger.
Yeah.
San Quentin Prison or something, was it? He was doing a
picture. Yeah, it was Jim Marshall.
Jim Marshall.
But I don't think
he looks like
he means
it,
and that wasn't published for a long time. It was considered to be so over-the-top.
Yeah, it was kind of risque. And then punk. It was kind of your standard.
That's almost being friendly, isn't it?
Well, there was a middle finger on an early Moby Grape album, and they had to paint it out.
Oh yes, yes they did. But you've also, I'm just intrigued by this, because a lot of the time you've worked with just quite simple setups. Is that fair to say? You'll turn up and you'll just take a picture of them wherever they happen to be.
Well, this was whilst they were doing a pop video.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. I see. Boys.
It might be Battersea Park.
Oh, right. You can't remember.
Certainly in that area. Yeah.
Oh, right. So you weren't responsible for saying to them, I tell you what, boys.
No.
Put on, you know, conical hats. And get in a rowing boat.
No, why do they do that? Is it because they think that? Although we do know them actually, is it because they think they're uneventful to photograph?
No, I think I think the director of the pop video had the idea and they'll storyboard it. And some of their pop videos were very elaborate and brilliant, really. But I mean, this looks quite pastoral, really, doesn't it? The video wasn't like that at all. It was quite futuristic.
What's the most significant picture you've ever taken of anybody? If I can put you on the spot.
I don't know, really.
If the Guardian was to ring you up for their my greatest picture, whatever that
picture
is. Oh, well,
they already have done it. It was a couple kissing in Gossips.
Oh, right.
Taken in 1979, and I just picked that. You know, it was first out of the
But an individual, you know,
well,
well-known musician?
I did enjoy photographing Keith Richards because he was so nice.
Oh, we have a picture of Keith Richards
and
coming
quite
up.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And I went with my wife because she insisted on assisting me. And he was very nice to her as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very warm. He was the first person that ever said to me, are you sure you've got enough? And I felt he really meant it.
Good grief. How long did you have?
Probably an hour.
You had an hour?
Yeah, maybe even longer.
You're very fortunate.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I once saw the Rolling Stones do an entire photo session for Mike Potland, I think, in a hotel room in Kensington in about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know,
well, they just shambled into the room, got themselves into a pose, and then as soon as the shutter was about to go, Mick just stuck his head forward like that, so they looked the most prominent on the picture. They were so practiced in doing it, you know, and then that's your lot.
Yeah.
You know, you're gone. Whereas you had an hour there.
I'd say, a good hour. Yeah, it was fantastic.
But I bet in every single one of those pictures, he was getting across that kind of brooding, kind of buccaneer.
I suppose he was,
vibe, which he just brilliantly does.
Yeah, no, he does, yeah. Yeah, no, he was...
Who was it who said? Was it Mick Brown once said, he's not so much a man who burns the candle at both ends, but applies a blowtorch to the middle. Yeah. Is that right? That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so. Because this is... This is before he had the stuff in his hair, is that right?
Well, Anton Corbijn, who's a pal of mine, photographed him around that time, and he was complaining about the fact he had little lacerations on his... He used to wake up in the morning and have little cuts on his face, and Anton had to point out that this was directly connected with the razor blades and little daggers that he had hanging in his hair, and maybe he should put little bits of gaffer tape around them before he went to bed at night. So it was an extraordinary thing. He went, oh, yeah, you might have a point, you know. Go back to the Spike Milligan picture. That's brilliant, though. Yeah. So tell us about that one. Is he a big hero of yours, or was he a big hero?
No, he was. My dad was a big fan. When I met him, I introduced myself and said, how are you? And he said to me, why? Why do you want to know? Are you a doctor? But apparently he said that to everybody.
Yes, sure.
he was nice, but I felt a little sad, you know.
Which you've caught there.
Yeah. I'm not really sure why, but...
Is that in his home? Is that
no,
hotel?
I think that might have been at his agent's place, which is near Marble Arch. Agent, manager.
Yeah.
He shared one, I think, with somebody else, the names. I've forgotten now, sorry.
Was Eric Sykes?
Yes, that was Eric Sykes. Eric Sykes was there
as well. So I just want to finish with the picture that is probably not typical.
Yeah.
But I just picked it out, the ones you sent me, because I thought, well, it's the European Championship. So
what was the purpose of that? Did you have a particular brief?
This was for Loaded. I think they just wanted to get the Spice Girls pretending to be footballers as in a lineup, as though they were about to have a free kick shot towards them. But
genitalia.
Yeah. The story that I have to tell here is that Victoria... at the time, she didn't have a football team. So she wasn't too sure what team she should wear. Someone showed her a photograph of David Beckham, and she decided to be a Man United supporter. Yeah, and so I think I am indirectly responsible for those two getting together.
That's brilliant.
That's very good work.
It really is.
Very good work. This is extraordinary here, actually, because with Sylvia, we're going to finish up with the picture of the Beckhams as well.
We are.
This is conceptual.
Perfectly circular.
It's absolutely perfect. When is this?
I think that was maybe 95, 96, something like that.
Now, what were they like to photograph?
They were fine, yeah, but perfectly... Pleasant, friendly people. I don't have anything bad to say about
them. No, I wasn't.
No, no. Dave was saying earlier to me that you know, we have great fondness for the Spice Girls.
So I like you put it,
they escape with their money and their sanity.
It seems to me, if everybody's been through the pop mill, the Spice Girls, they win. Because they came out with the money and their sanity. And their fame, actually.
Yeah. And they were brilliant.
They're not figures of fun, you know.
When we were at EMAP, when they started out, they came into the building where all the magazines were, and they went up to Smash Hits magazine, knocked on the door, and said, "We're the Spice Group called the Spice Girls. Can we come and sing in your office?" And Smash Hits said, "No." Do you remember? Sorry, we're a bit busy. Actually, doing some work. You know, I'm just transcribing my blur feature or whatever it was. And so they went to Big Magazine round the corner. Do you remember? And then did a cappella did their first two singles?
Yeah,
which is fantastic, really.
And that's where they got the name of... that's where they got the names Posh, Scary and so forth.
Yes, well, was it Number One magazine? No, it was another magazine.
I thought it was Top of the Pops magazine.
Peter
Lorraine, wasn't it?
Right,
who has the honour of giving them that name. But you played an important part in bringing together Posh and Beck's, you know, the marriage of the century. So, you know, that's a heck of a thing. That's not reflected in this book, but lots of other stuff that we've talked about is... And I'm sure if you'd like a copy and like to get it signed, Derek would be only too happy to do that. The book's called Punk London, 1977. Would you please show your
copies
appreciation?
Copies are available.
Derek Ridges. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Derek.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.